You're listening to the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast, where Irish fitness entrepreneur Brian Keane answers your questions and interviews leaders in the world of fitness, health, mindset, and natural wellness. Come join the fun.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Brian Keane Fitness Podcast. We talk everything fitness, nutrition, and mindset to help you with your goals. So some of you were listening to last week's episode, so this episode is pre-recorded because as I speak right now, I am running 256 kilometers through the Sahara Desert in Morocco. I'm running for the Laura Lynn charity. So for anyone that has already sponsored that, an amazing charity, Children's Hospice, where they work with parents of sick and dying children, it actually breaks my heart. They're just the most incredible charity. So a massive thank you to everybody who sponsored for that charity and my run that I'm currently doing, the Marathon de Sable. If not, you can head over to my Instagram and you can do a swipe up in my highlights. Every little helps. They're just an amazing charity. They're all funded privately, so important that they're able to get as much as possible throughout the year. So right now, I am recording this directly after last week's episode because I didn't want to upset the podcast schedule. But if you've been following my Instagram, you've seen that I'm running through sand dunes right now. So be sure to check out Brian Keane Fitness on Instagram and you'll see everything from the Sahara. Anytime I'm in internet coverage, I'm going to be posting up different things that I can, but I'm going to be off the grid for 5 or 6 days. So very excited for that. Right now, that is what I'm doing. So if you go on Instagram after this, I will be getting my team to upload this week's podcast and everything else that will be going out for the next couple of days. So massive thank you for the support, and be sure to check out that journey, and we'll get straight into today's podcast. So today's podcast is a Q&A where I pool questions from mostly Instagram today. Spending a lot of time on Instagram at the minute, some on Snapchat, BrianK019 on Snapchat, but mostly from Instagram today because it is probably my most active platform at the minute. First question comes in from Instagram. How can I avoid eating junk food? I feel like I'm always craving it. So one of the approaches that I like to take to junk food is systems over willpower. And for people that have came through my program or are coming through my program, particularly my BKF online program, which is my program for losing body fat, getting leaner, building muscle, not necessarily for athletes. My GA Lean Body program is very much for the GA players, athletes looking for that aesthetic look. My BKF online is people working with me and my coaches for 8 weeks. And anyone coming through that has an issue with junk food, one of the things I'll offer after the first week or two when we eliminate some of the foods that can potentially cause cravings and make them worse that I'll get to in this answer is understanding that systems beat willpower when it comes to junk food and realizing that there's actually nothing wrong with you for physically craving certain junk food because it is addictive. The ingredient foods that tend to make up junk food, potato chips or crisps, salt, your sugars, your chocolate bars, your ice cream, your sugars and different fats like trans fatty acids or fast food, they are all foods that we're evolutionarily designed to crave because of time and ancestral man when food was short or there was a shortage of food. Things that were calorie dense could keep you alive. And if you were going through the savannah, it was unlikely that you were going to get a lot of sugar, but you may come across some honey and it was very, very easy to consume a lot of it and get a lot of calories and gave you a very instant energy hit, which was very, very supportive for ancestral man. Whereas now we don't have that lack of access to food in the Western world for the most part, and realizing that a lot of junk food is built off the evolutionary addictiveness that we have, and there's nothing wrong with you for craving it because that's the way you're designed. We have a 10,000 year old mind that is still hardwired to crave those foods. And that's why systems are so important, because it's hard to give up a lot of those foods when you're physically craving them or you physically feel like you need them. But realizing there's nothing wrong with you for having that craving. Again, people will have personal preferences. Some people prefer savory and salt and Chinese and potato chips and crisps. Other people prefer sugars, ice cream, chocolate. Again, but knowing that that's a physiological craving that you're having for those foods, particularly when you consume them and you can eat them and you want more and more and more and more and more after you've had a taste of them. You know, like Pringles are a great example. They probably, that monosodium glutamate, which is one of the worst things you can put into your body, is an ingredient in a lot of potato chips and was an ingredient in Pringles for years. I'm not sure if it's still in there, but they would test people to go try and have one, you know, and it was impossible to nearly just have one Pringle. You felt like you had to keep craving and eating more and more and more again. Because there was ingredients put into these foods to make you physically crave them. So realizing that when you want to cut junk food, sometimes an understanding of what's happening in your body can be enough to put you off it. Other times you have to build the systems in place. And then other times you have to make sure that you are avoiding certain foods and certain drinks that can make those cravings worse. So the first thing I do with people coming through my programs, regardless of what version of it is or what each person's goals is, we tend to minimize, particularly initially for the first week, minimize certain ingredients with people that are suffering from bad cravings that can potentially make your cravings worse. So again, context is key because we don't do this with everybody. But if somebody's coming through and the first thing they put in their questionnaire is, I've got really bad cravings and I'm really struggling with them, is I'm going to cut out things like polyalcohols from protein bars for a week or so. I'm going to cut out things like sweeteners from diet drinks for a week or so. Switch to water just to see how your body responds. Because there's certain ingredient types, your sweeteners, your polyalcohols can all potentially make your cravings worse. For some people, they don't. This doesn't affect everybody. For some other people, it can mimic insulin, which makes your body give a negative feedback loop that you're getting something sugary. And as a result, when you have a polyalcohol, you have a certain sweetener and you get that negative feedback loop in your body and your pancreas releases insulin. You think you actually are getting something sugary and then you just have a sweetener instead. It can make your cravings worse physiologically later on in the day. So that's one of the first things, to just minimize for a week or so, see how your body responds. And when you do that, a lot of people will find that their cravings disappear nearly in the space of a week. It feels like it's overnight because one day you go from having terrible cravings to not having them anymore. And I think it's something that is worth experimenting with if you are really struggling with cravings. There's certain ingredients that can make it worse. Generally, I can tell when I look at someone's food and nutrition, I can kind of tell what foods are probably causing bad cravings. So the one thing is, if you're somebody that is consuming those foods or diet drinks or protein bars or certain sweeteners from, you know, your, that you're putting into your coffee or your tea, it may be worth experimenting with cutting those out for a week and seeing how your cravings respond and see how your body or your mind responds to not having those foods in your diet for a week or so. The next thing is understanding that systems in place can be better than actually using willpower to try and avoid the food. So in this, for me, as somebody that has a really bad sweet tooth, I live by the alcohol anonymous quote I just applied to sugar. If you don't want to slip, don't go to slippery places. Which means don't keep your junk food in your house. For those of you who signed up to my 14 days of fat loss on my website, which is just a free tip a day into your inbox on my website, briankeefitness.com, tip one is clear out your junk food. So when you have systems in place over willpower, if you clear out those foods that you don't want to binge on, or clear out those foods that are, you know what, that you class and put into the bracket as junk food, don't have them in the house, because then you're relying on willpower to say no. And when you know it's there, it's a lot harder to say no to it. I know if I keep chocolate in the house, there's a good chance I'm going to eat it. So I generally just don't buy it unless I've actually factored it in to have it at that moment or that day or that weekend or whatever it is. So systems over willpower. And if you don't want to slip, don't go to slippery places. If you don't want to have junk food, then don't buy junk food and don't keep it into your house. Then the last thing is understanding that it's not the junk food that's terrible in general, and that the danger is in the dose. So for certain people, if you're eating McDonald's every day and you're having ice cream every day and you're having all these different junk foods, you're going to get a negative compound effect of being used to having those foods, and then you're going to crave them and it's going to become part of your habit and part of your routine. But factoring them in once a week or twice a week, and that's allowing you to stay on track long term because you actually enjoy those foods, that can be the key to long-term success and not a case of feast or famine where you have nothing for 2 or 3 weeks and then you binge for 2 or 3 days because you've got such a bad craving and you want the junk food and you get a taste of sugar or you get a taste of fast food or you get a taste of salt and then you can't control it. Again, a little bit is reverse engineering your personality type. Some people can do that. Some people are perfectly fine going 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks without any junk food and then binging for a couple of days and then going straight back on it and then they work with that. But for a lot of people, factoring it in either a small bit every day where you don't open the floodgates and go crazy with junk food, or factoring it in once or twice a week with a free meal. I'm not a massive fan of the word cheat meal because I think it has a negative connotation with food, but some of you will have a label as a cheat meal. So a cheat meal or a free meal once a week with those foods isn't going to set you back long term, particularly if it's keeping you on track. So it's a little bit, as I said, of danger in the dose. If you're eating chips and burgers from McDonald's every single day and you're eating ice cream and Ben and Jerry's every single night, it's probably not going to support your fitness goals that much. Again, a lot of context is key. But when you're trying to reduce it, put yourself in the best position to do it. So number one, eliminate the foods that are potentially going to make your cravings worse. Number two, clear them out of your cupboard and make sure you're not keeping them in your house. Systems over willpower. If you don't want to slip, don't go to slippery places. And three, factor them in so that if you're not going feast or famine and you're not completely giving it up. And then the last thing that I actually forgot to mention was educating yourself on what happens with your body. This is the one that really changed it for me. And one of the reasons I don't consume fast food and haven't in 11 or 12 years is understanding my knowledge on trans fatty acids, which is, for those of you who read my book, The Fitness Mindset, in the nutrition section, in the fat section, that I spoke about all the healthy fats to include in your diet. And then I spoke about the poison, which is trans fatty acids. It's the only food group that I can really not argue a positive side for. You know, I love the old adage, the Charlie Munger quote, that you shouldn't have an opinion on something unless you can argue the opposite side better than the people who hold the opinion on that side. Trans fatty acids is very, very difficult to argue a positive side because it's poison for your body. In terms of, for anyone's ever seen a chemical makeup of a fatty acid, trans means is opposite for Latin, is the Latin for opposite side, and the chemical makeup of the hydrogen ion on a fatty acid is actually on the opposite side on a trans fatty acid. So what happens is when your body consumes it, it doesn't understand and recognize what it is, so it shuttles it into fat stores, which is the safest place to keep it away from vital organs. So one of the reasons that fast food and high diets and trans fatty acids can have such a negative impact on your fat loss goals is because you're literally just adding it to fat stores. Your body's not burning through it. It's not effectively using it for a fuel source like it would, say, sugar, which will just go back and get converted back to glycogen in excess, will get converted back to body fat, even though sugar is not great for your body either. At least you can burn through it. Trans fatty acids don't do that. So that's why a little bit of knowledge, when I understood that I was figuratively putting up another wall for myself to jump over when I was trying to get my body fat down, it made me never want to consume that food again. So, and I've had a lot of feedback from the book of people that read that section and had felt the same way, and as a result, don't consume fast food anymore. So a little bit of it can be building your knowledge on what happens to your body. And when you understand that all the work you have to put in to just balance out the negative effect of consuming, you know, things like fast food, for example, particularly if it's more than once a week, that can stop you doing it, from personal experience and from people that gave me feedback on that section of the book and some of the Amazon reviews. So that's probably the last thing I would offer in terms of junk food. So again, find what works for you. Find what foods you need to eliminate to minimize your cravings. Make sure that you're not keeping those foods in your house. Then factoring them in each week and then maybe building your knowledge on what actually happens when you consume different sugars, different fatty acids, different saturated fats with sugars in terms of cholesterol issues. And when you start to do that, you can make the choices of what's going to work best for you. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. If your cravings keep getting worse and worse and you're not doing anything to change them, it's very unlikely that they're just going to stop overnight. So put the strategies in place and hopefully that will massively support you with eliminating or avoiding or at least minimizing the amount of junk food you eat. Okay, next question comes in from Instagram. Do you ever hit the wall midday from getting up so early in the morning? I get up at 5 a.m. like you, but always feel drained by 11 a.m. and need a nap. It takes me so long to get going after the nap, and it takes a big chunk of my day. Any help would be great. So I'm going to answer this question because I think getting up early is very, very relative. For some people, 7 a.m. is early. For other people, 8 a.m., 9 a.m. is early. And I think the principle is the same in terms of most people get that midday slump. It just tends to be at a different time depending on what time you get up. So I'm going to give a little bit of context by giving two scenarios here that will hopefully support and help anybody who's trying to minimize or avoid that midday slump. When I used to work full-time as a primary school teacher, I used to get up about 7:30 in the morning, and I would be in work for 8. I used to go straight in, I used to have my breakfast and work, and then we would start school at 9. And then every day at 3, just before the kids would go home, I would get this massive slump where I would just feel completely drained, and then I used to get a little bit of a second wind again around 7 or 8 p.m. It's funny because that slump was way worse when I would get up at 7:30 than it is now when I get up at 5 a.m. because I don't get that slump anymore. But I'm going to offer a couple of changes that I've made in my life, in my nutrition, in my sleep cycles, in my lifestyle choices in general, in terms of productivity times, that has completely hacked this and is one of the reasons now that I largely don't get that slump. So regardless of whether you get up at 5 a.m., 6 a.m., 7 a.m. or 8 a.m., hopefully these tips and tricks will help you so that you don't get that slump where you need to take a nap. And if you do decide to take a nap, that how to avoid getting that sluggish, not knowing what year it is when you wake up. I love the meme on social media, when you go for a nap, you feel either super refreshed or you wake up and don't know what year it is. And there's reasons for that, and I'm going to talk about it in this answer. So the first change I made was understanding that it's not about sleep quantity, it is about sleep quality. And I spoke in the sleep section of my book about REM cycles and rapid eye movement sleep cycles, which is the importance of getting high quality sleep as opposed to quantity. There's a great book by Nick Littlehales called Sleep. He's a sports sleep expert, and he spoke a lot about the different sleep cycles and how it didn't matter how much sleep we got as long as the quality of it was good. And I spoke about it in my book where I fleshed it out and spoke that to fall into those 90-minute REM cycles, and we fall into 90-minute sleep cycles, so that you're better off waking up at the end of one REM cycle instead of waking up having got extra sleep, waking up midway through another REM cycle. So that looks like going to bed and getting 6 hours of sleep, 7.5 hours of sleep, or 9 hours of sleep, and setting your alarm so you wake up on that time. If you wake up after 8 hours or 8.5 hours, you're midway through another sleep cycle, so you can wake up feeling way more groggy. For me, it takes me about 30 minutes to unwind every night, where I put my head in a pillow and it takes me about 30 minutes to fall asleep, and then I get 7.5 hours from that point. I know myself, I need to give myself an 8-hour window because I'm going to take 30 minutes to fall asleep and I want my 7.5. And I get that nearly every single morning. I tend to go to bed every night at 9 a.m. or 9 p.m. as physically as often as I can because I get up every morning at 5 a.m. So that has helped me. For some people, that may shift. You don't need to get up at 5 a.m. I find I'm very productive at that time because a lot of the world isn't awake yet, and I can get a lot of my creative work done, my writing, different videos that I'm making, different stuff that I'm working on in programs. I can get that done in the morning, and then 9 a.m. comes and I can do a lot more reactive work where I'm responding to emails or messages, and I'm able to get the best of both worlds in terms of creative cycles and reactive cycles and get the most out of my day. So hacking my sleep was number one. So that's what I apply. So now I wake up feeling a lot fresher, even though I don't want to get up at 5 a.m. because I'm not a morning person by nature. I get up and I'm feeling fresher and I can go about my day. The next thing was my nutrition. When I was working full-time as a teacher, and I was in really good shape even as a teacher, because fitness has always been a large part of my lifestyle. I know really good shape is very relative to each person, but in terms of me, I was physically fit. I was going to the gym regularly, and I thought I was eating a lot healthier food than I was. And I've spoke about this in the podcast in the past, about the difference between health food and fitness food. And I didn't understand the difference because I thought they were the same. I was eating a lot of protein bars. I was using diet drinks. I was using a lot of frozen foods, microwave rice, all kind of considered fitness food that was fitting into my macros. And I looked, I was lean. I had muscle. I had a lean physique. But my energy levels weren't that good. And I spoke about that in the energy section of my book, in the nutrition section, about the difference between energy and the difference between fitness and health. And I've spoke about it a lot in previous episodes of the podcast. When I changed over to eating higher quality foods and more nutrient dense foods, and there were some of these really simple changes, going from microwave rice to full to normal rice, going from proper full chicken instead of packaged chicken, from going from fresh veg from frozen veg, even though there's argument that there's vitamin C content is higher in certain frozen veg. I made these changes, and as a result, I was getting a lot more vitamins and minerals and nutrients into my body that I wasn't getting as tired. And I still don't get that tired anymore. I'm very, very fortunate that I'm productive during the day and my energy levels are good. And it comes down to my nutrition. And what happened was, when you combine quality sleep with nutrient-dense foods and you're increasing your energy, you don't tend to get that slump as bad. One of the hacks that I use with people coming through my programs for that midday slump is green tea extract, which is a small bit of caffeine. Taking that during that slump, it can just lift you up so you don't end up reaching for something, you know, super stimulated, like a can of Monster or a Red Bull, if that's not your cup of tea in terms of what drinks you want to consume, or biscuits or sugar. Because at that midday slump, regardless of whether that's 3 p.m., which for me it was 3 p.m., whether you're not reaching for those foods, having that green tea extract, particularly for the first couple of weeks as you transition over to higher quality foods and better sleep cycles, can just hack that so you're not reaching for stimulated drinks and you're not reaching for sugary foods, which can have a negative feedback loop that can give you energy for a certain period of time and then your blood sugar levels crash and then you need something else to pick you up and then you're in this negative feedback loop where you're going sugar, energy's up, back down, need something sugary, energy's back up, back down, and then you're trying to play catch up for the rest of the day. So nutrition is huge in terms of that's one change over into higher nutrient dense foods. The last thing then was a little bit of self-awareness on productivity around certain times of the day. So I'm in a very fortunate position that the way that my life is now, it wasn't so much when I was teaching for 4 years, but when the way my life is now, I can change my day and be productive around the morning times, and again, I get a second wind in the evening, and I know that things are a struggle for me during the day. And I'm gonna share how this can support and help and impact you, even if you're working a regular 9-to-5 office job where you don't have control of your own hours. And what I found is certain people have certain productivity energy at certain times of the day, and protecting that time is very, very important. So what I would offer is get your most important tasks done at your high energy times during the day. So for example, even if you work in an office 9-to-5, and this is something, if I had ever gone back teaching, which is something that I'll probably never do at this stage, I will, as much as I miss working with kids, I'll probably be doing it in another avenue. But the way that I would go back, if I could go back 5-6 years ago, is I would have done my most productive things in the morning, my lesson plans, my prepping the day. I would have done it when I was fresh. And then I would have saved the more reactive tasks that I was working with the kids for later on in the day. Teaching's a little bit harder because you're not in an office and you're not in control at all because there's 30 other kids in the room with you. But in terms of how that would look for majority of people, is protecting that time that can be used to get the things that really need to be done, done. And that sounds really obvious, but I've been a victim in the past of procrastinating on my most important tasks through the day. I love the Gary Kelleher book, The One Thing, where he speaks that really, if we break down our to-do list, and I was really bad for this, where I would have 10 or 12 things on my to-do list. Normally when you break it down, there's normally one thing that you really need to get done that day. If you get it done, it makes the day a success and it makes everything else either null and void and it doesn't need to be done or can be pushed on to another day because it's not super important. But normally we avoid that most important task because it's either hard or it's difficult or it's confrontational or we just don't want to do it. Now I tend to eat the frog, the Brian Tracy, eat the frog. If you eat a frog first thing in the morning, the whole day is up from there. I do my most important tasks and my most productive time first thing in the morning and then I get it done. It's why I do my creative work in the morning when that time is protected. The reason I get up at 5 a.m. is because there's nobody else to take that time. My daughter's asleep. My family's asleep. There's nobody around to even text because most people are in bed. And that allows me to get my most important tasks done. You can hack that as well in your office. You can hack that as well in your job. And then if you do get that slump at 2 or 3 or 4 p.m. or whenever you get it, it doesn't really matter. You can just kind of enjoy it and chill on Facebook, go on to Instagram, listen to an audiobook, listen to a podcast. If you're in the office, you're probably chatting to people anyway, but knowing safe in the knowledge that you've got your most important task done. That's just a little hack that isn't anything physiological, but can make you emotionally way more happy throughout the day, because there's nothing worse than going home at 5 p.m. from a job and you haven't got your most important task of the day done, or worse, it comes on at 2 or 3 p.m. where you have to get it done and you're feeling tired and drained and run down and it's taking you 2 hours to do a job that would have taken you 40 minutes if you had done it in the morning. So hacking that can make you feel so much more emotionally secure and you don't feel bad when you get tired later on in the day, and then you can actually enjoy it by doing things that are more reactive, that don't take as much cognitive thought, and then you save in the knowledge that your most productive thing is done during the day. The last thing that I'll offer is the nap timing. And I made the joke earlier that the meme on social media that you may have seen where you wake up after a nap and you feel either super refreshed, ready to take on the day, or you don't know what year it is. The reason for this is napping too long for the large part. This took me years to figure out because I experimented with napping. It's not something that massively works and supports me now, but for years I implemented it into my lifestyle, and particularly when I was doing a lot more training in terms of 2-day splits, when I was traveling, when I had photo shoots or bodybuilding shows or whatever it was I was doing, that nap really helped my recovery in terms of my cognitive thought during the day and my ability to get my workouts done, particularly my 2-day splits. But one of the mistakes I made, and your mess becomes your message, and I lived it, is when you sleep too long and you start to drop actually into a deep sleep and then you wake up, you end up waking up way more groggy than you were when you went down in the first place. But it's very, very difficult to hack this. So normally that sweet spot for a nap is between 10 and 20 minutes for people. But it's so hard to get up from the nap. What I did was I used to set an alarm and put it on the other side of the room. So I physically had to get up. Even though after 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, I'm still tired. I want to go back to sleep for another half an hour or 40 minutes. I had to physically get up to turn off the alarm. And then when I was up, I was fine. And then I felt really refreshed. When I was sleeping for longer than that, 30 minutes, 35 minutes, 40 minutes, I was waking up and I didn't know what day it was because I was way more tired than I was when I went to sleep first. That doesn't support you because it takes another hour and a half for you just to wake up, and actually defeats the purpose of having the nap in the first place. That normally comes down to having a lot of self-control. It's one of the reasons I cut it, because I was finding that 10-minute nap difficult to get up from, and as good as my self-control is, it wasn't supporting me enough in terms of the other strategies I built in with sleep cycles and nutrition that actually helped me more. So as a result, I don't need the naps anymore. But if you are someone that's still napping, be aware that there's loads of studies. Check out PubMed, check out different studies that have been done on dropping too deep into sleep cycles during a nap. And that's the reason you're feeling so tired and fatigued when you get up and finding your sweet spot. Some people it might be 5 minutes, some people it might be 7 minutes, some people it might be 12 or 15 minutes. Experiment with it, find your sweet spot, and then be really, really strict on the time you set, because that will massively support you in waking up and getting all the benefit that you will actually get from a nap. And I also recommend that book by Nick Littlehale, Sleep. A great read, particularly for any athletes out there. He worked with a lot of the top British cyclists and a lot of the top Premier League clubs in terms of improving the sleep for those athletes. So highly recommend that book as well. Okay, next question comes from Instagram. I've heard you mention CrossFit a few times. What's your opinion on it? I've been doing it a while and I love it, but not as happy with my body composition than when I was doing normal weight training. What are your thoughts? So I like CrossFit, like most things. There's parts of CrossFit I love and parts of CrossFit I hate. Like the truth is, parts of CrossFit are incredible. I love what it's done in general for people in terms of I remember a time, and I'm a long time in the fitness industry, I remember a time when lifting weights for females was massively taboo, where girls thought they were going to get big and bulky. And CrossFit over the last 5, 6, 7 years has really broken down those barriers in terms of, look, if you lift weights as a female, you're going to get toned and lean and you're going to look amazing. CrossFit has really broken that down, particularly for girls. And that's one of the reasons why I've got a nice attachment with it. I love that it's done that because it was so mainstream for a while and it broke down that misconception because that's what it is. It's a misconception. Lifting weights for a female, you're going to get lean and muscular and toned and you're going to look amazing. It's not going to make you big and bulky. You don't have enough natural testosterone. You're probably not consuming enough calories to get jacked. And you just don't have the natural hormones, but you will get really, really lean and your clothes will fit you better. Your stomach will get flat. Your shoulders will get good and everything will look amazing depending on the program you're following. So I like that CrossFit broke down that barrier. Parts of CrossFit I don't like, the kipping pull-ups, I think are fucking stupid. And the stupid Olympic lifts to failure. Anything where you're lifting your maximum weight above your head, the law of gravity is going to work against you on that. I think that's stupid. But that comes down to the CrossFit boxes. That comes down to the instructors. If you have amazing instructors and there's loads of incredible CrossFit coaches, load of incredible CrossFit boxes. My friend Marcus, who was on the podcast recently, has a CrossFit box in Dubai. He's amazing, and his coaches that he works with, you're not going to get those stupid workouts that can potentially damage and injure people. That being said, the same as any gym or any fitness program, you're going to have coaches and programs and gyms and boxes where they're doing stupid shit that can hurt people. That's my only issue with it. So there's the pros and the cons. When I used to live in London, I did a lot of CrossFit, and my body responded really, really well to it. I was really lean. My metabolism was through the roof from the Metcons. I never did the stupid stuff because I probably had enough knowledge of fitness to know don't do an Olympic snatch to failure with your one rep max, which is just ridiculous. As I said, gravity will come against you. But I loved the Metcons, the metabolic conditionings. Some of those principles I apply in my own training now, and I apply in some of my own programs. But in this question, in terms of changing body composition, CrossFit is a little bit of a catch-22 because CrossFit by its nature is crossing across different fitnesses. So there's elements of strongman in there. There's elements of Olympic lifting in there. There's elements of conditioning in there. So your workouts very much vary depending on what it is of the WOD or the workout of the day or whatever it is that that box or gym is doing that day. For those of you that don't know, CrossFit people normally refer to their gym as a box. So I'll be using gym and box interchangeably here for CrossFit. And that may not support you changing your body composition that quickly or in alignment with what it actually is you're trying to achieve. One of the reasons that some females in particular can get amazing results with CrossFit or guys that haven't done weights before and get amazing results with CrossFit is that it's a pretty good introduction to training because you're going to train fucking hard. CrossFitters train like demons. Some of those workouts are so hard and they're a really good way of just taxing your body. So you're forcing it to change. That being said, it only depends on the workouts that you're doing. So for example, if you're going in and doing Olympic lifts 3 times a week and you're trying to change your body composition so you've got bigger glutes or so you've got a flatter stomach or that your body fat just reduces, you may not be tearing enough fibers down. You may not be elevating your metabolism enough in order to burn the calories you need to burn to reduce your body fat so you can change your composition so you look the way you want to look. If you're doing 5 Metcons a week, which are metabolic conditioning, which are super high volume workouts for 40 to 60 minutes or sometimes shorter, where you're working for a lot of glycolic, where you're taking your glycogen, you're taking your glucose, you're burning through all of that in a very short period of time, that may support your body composition goals faster. So your one size fits all in CrossFit may be working against you if you're trying to change your body composition. So that's kind of the issue that I would have with it. And it's not so much an issue as if you're enjoying it, you love the camaraderie, and I love that aspect of CrossFit where they built a community around it, particularly the good gyms, the good boxes have built the community aspect around CrossFit where everybody knows each other, everybody comes in and they train hard and they go for a couple of beers after, or they talk about the nutrition and the paleolithic element of eating is very, very strong in CrossFit. Again, that's box dependent. Sometimes in some boxes don't have any element on nutrition, which is always going to set you back, because you can train to the hardest of your ability and you can do incredible workouts, but if you don't fix your nutrition, you're going to limit your body's ability to change its composition. So again, a lot of it will come down to the coaches and the boxes that you're in. So it's not a one size, yes, CrossFit works for everybody. One size, no, CrossFit doesn't work for anybody. It depends. It depends on the box. It depends on the coaches. It depends on the workouts they're doing within that box. And then it depends on the nutrition that you're eating, because the nutritional strategy you're following, it's going to be important that you are either consuming a surplus or consuming a deficit or playing around with your carbohydrate depending on the workouts you're doing, based around whatever it is you're trying to achieve. I've had CrossFitters come through my program and they follow a couple of elements of my training program and then follow all the nutrition, and then we coach it for the 8 weeks in the BKF online program. But it's very important that the nutrition aspect is covered, because you are going to limit your body's ability to change its composition if you don't align your training with your nutrition or your nutrition with your training. So my thoughts is there's a reason that you got better body composition response when you were doing normal weight training. One, you were probably tearing more fibers and working specifically for the muscles you were trying to change. So if you were working your glutes and shoulders more and increasing the load on those muscle groups, you were probably changing those compositions so that they looked better. You were probably focused more on nutrition, because regular weight training and gym training and resistance training normally comes very much hand in hand with following a certain nutritional strategy, where in CrossFit it doesn't as much. It's more let's just train hard and then kind of eat what we want, or let's eat paleo depending on the box. And then third, it's finding what is working best for you long term and realizing that you could probably combine the best of both worlds, where you do a little bit of normal resistance training, particularly around the body parts that you're trying to improve. So glutes, shoulders, abs, arms, whatever it is you're trying to improve, you build your nutritional strategy around that, and then you keep your CrossFit because you love it in terms of training, you love the camaraderie, you love it, the effect it has on your body, you're pushing your mental and physical limits. That's an element of CrossFit that I particularly love. You're working to barriers or working to limits that you thought you had physically, and you tend to crush past those or smash past those doing CrossFit workouts because of the intensity level that a lot of those Metcons and WODs in particular have. So understand that the reason you saw changes before was probably the combination of physically working for body composition changes, and that's why your body changed. Whereas CrossFit, you're not specifically working for body composition changes. It's nearly a byproduct, and it's nearly a side benefit that you get, where you're training for function and training to your maximum, working your mindset and pushing past those limits, which is the high element of what CrossFit is and what it does. And knowing that if you want to combine the best of both worlds, you can totally do that. You just have to design your nutritional strategy around it, factor in a little bit of normal weight training, and then build your CrossFit into it, particularly if you're enjoying it so much. Okay, next question. Is there anything you can do to help me with a breakup? I broke up with my ex-girlfriend and I think I made a big mistake. She doesn't want to get back together. What should I do? So before I answer this question, I'm obviously going to put a disclaimer that I'm not a relationship coach. I've spoken on past episodes on different contexts of personal relationships with people, and I have a pretty good understanding of human misjudgment and psychological misjudgment that a lot of people have, and particularly that in combination with being objective on any particular question allows me to offer a fresh vantage point. So I'm by no means saying that I'm a relationship expert, but I have got the benefit of being completely objective on offering a different viewpoint and a good understanding of human psychology and why we do what we do that will hopefully help support you. So I'm going to try and give as much benefit as I can to the way you're seeing it, and potentially different choices that you may make going forward that will support you feeling better about the whole situation. So the first thing that jumps out here is I've heard this question very regularly. It's normally worded in different ways, and the names will regularly change. Sometimes it's a boy, guy that sends it in, sometimes it's a girl that sends it in. But what happens with a lot of cases, particularly if you've broken up with somebody and then you've regretted it and you feel like you've made the wrong choice. And I spoke in the podcast last week about the System 1 and System 2 that Daniel Kahneman speaks about in Thinking Fast and Slow. I spoke about it in the context of that I, by my nature, particularly for the first quarter of my life, first 25 years, 24 years of my life, I was very, very impulsive in terms of making decisions. I was very, very not using logical reasoning when I would make decisions. I would go off gut feeling and I would lead with impulsivity. And that put me into a lot more problems than it was worth. And over the last 4, 5, 6 years, I've been really honing that system too, which is your logical reasoning, your actual looking in objectively on a situation and not working off impulse. So the first thing that jumps out at me here, and the reason that I bring that up, System 1 and System 2, is because there's a section in that book in Thinking Fast and Slow, and it talks about the misremembering bias that we have. And for those of you that are unfamiliar with the book, which is an international bestseller, the misremembering bias is when we misremember things. And the way I always tie it and understand it better is a lot of us are very familiar with the term misunderstood and misunderstanding. So to understand something means you get the concept, you understand it. To misunderstand it means that you didn't get the concept or you mistaken it for a different way that the person had implied. Misremembering's a little bit similar. So the way we remember certain situations is we think that because it happened a certain way, we remember it a certain way. And misremembering is when we look back on a situation like a relationship or like a job or like an experience, and we don't remember it for how we actually felt when we were in that relationship or in that job or in that moment in time. And Daniel Kahneman speaks about that there's two selves. There's our experiencing self and there's our remembering self. Our experiencing self is the person that's actually living through the relationship. So in the context of, you know, breaking up with your girlfriend, your experiencing self was going through that relationship and was feeling a certain way during the relationship. So, for example, this showed up in my life, particularly in relationships, when I would be miserable in a relationship with somebody, or it showed up in certain places when I would go traveling to a place. And Paris is always the one I remember, because when I was in Paris, it was one of those cities that I just didn't really enjoy. Now, I loved Rome, I loved London, I loved New York. And what was happening was when I went to Paris, I didn't really enjoy it. My experience in self was like this. I didn't really enjoy this experience as much as I thought I would. However, when I came back 6 months later, I would remember all the positive things from the Paris experience. I would think, oh, the Eiffel Tower was cool, or walking down the Champs-Élysées was cool. I was misremembering what I experienced during that time in Paris. And the same in relationships. When I would be in a relationship and I felt really closed off and really completely shut down in terms of my emotional response in certain relationships that I was in, and then 6 months later, 8 months later, when I was broke up, I would remember the good times. I would remember all the amazing times and the holidays we were on, or the, you know, the amazing conversations that we had, and I would misremember how I experienced for that 80-90%. And what can happen with a lot of breakups, particularly if you're the person who broke up with somebody, assuming that you didn't just do it impulsively, assuming that you broke up with somebody, we can misremember the relationship. So we look back on it and we start to see all the good things. And we have the positive bias of looking back at all the positive moments, and then they end up taking more weight and outweighing the negatives. And we completely forget about our experiencing self, about how we were when we were actually in that relationship. You may have been completely closed off. You may have been miserable and you may have wanted to go out with the lads. You may have wanted to go out with the girls. You may have wanted to hook up with somebody else. You may have been completely interested in somebody else. But we forget that experiencing self, and we remember the good times and we misremember how we felt in the relationship. So the first thing I would offer for anybody that's in a situation, and this goes for other areas of life, this goes for relationships, this goes for jobs, this goes for environments, experiences that you've had, ask yourself, how did you actually feel? What was the difference between your experiencing self and what are you remembering now? Because they're not the same thing. And when you go back to that situation, normally there's a lot of cause and effect. When you break up with somebody, it was normally because something happened and you weren't happy in that relationship. And particularly when you broke up with them, it's a sign that there was something off somewhere. And unless that fundamental reason for breaking up has changed, it's very unlikely that that's going to be fixed by going back in and you're just misremembering the situation because you're remembering all the positive times as opposed to the reason you broke up in the first place. By all means, some cases where you broke up with somebody because you had to move away and it was circumstantial and environmental and you regret it, that can be different because it's not an underlying cause. You didn't cheat on somebody, she didn't cheat on you, you weren't interested in somebody else, you didn't want to go out with the lads. It wasn't something that was fundamentally wrong in the relationship. It was literally, well, I had to move country and that's why we broke up. That's different. But what happens with a lot of cases, and in 95, 96% of cases, anytime I've answered this on a Q&A or something similar, it's people that are misremembering. And the reason I wanted to answer this in the podcast is because when I spoke about this in Snapchat Q&A, which is where this question came up first, the guy messaged me back. He's like, you're right. He goes, I was miserable in that relationship. And I was like, yeah, you were probably misremembering. So one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up onto the podcast is I know I have a different audience that listen on here. And as it's something that I have made the mistake myself, and I've built up the phantom girlfriend in my head. There's a great book, I can't remember the author, but it's called Attached, where he speaks about our phantom girlfriend or phantom boyfriend, that when we break up with somebody a year later, we look back and we put them on a pedestal of how great they are. Or if we get with somebody else, we're starting to hold them to the standard of that previous person, and we have this phantom person that we think is incredible. That's another form of misremembering. And as somebody that's experienced that myself, I understand that it's just a psychological misjudgment that we have, that your brain is taking the simple way out and it's getting confused between your experiencing self and your remembering self, and it's making up these stories to put yourself at ease for whatever it is that you're trying to deal with in terms of, did I make the mistake? So I would ask yourself, are you misremembering? If you're not, and you genuinely think you made a mistake and you really want to get back with your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever the relationship situation is, by all means, once you've dealt with that and you realize you're doing it for the right reasons, you can literally bring that information to the person and go, look, I'm not misremembering this. I was really happy. I made a mistake. Can we give it another go? But my gut tells me and my logical reasoning tells me that there's a good chance that you will look back in the relationship and realize that you were misremembering because there was a reason that you broke up in the first place. And unless that has changed, that's still going to be an issue. So you're just going to go back into the same situation. And the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. To go back into a relationship where there was a fundamental flaw and there was a problem initially, and the experiencing, both of you were having an experience where you weren't enjoying it, to go back into that relationship, the same thing's going to happen again because you haven't fixed the fundamental flaw. So hopefully that helps. And anybody else that is in a similar environment or situation, I hope this helps. And if you have any friends that are dealing with breakups, either on the receiving side or on the breakup side, be sure to send them to this part of the podcast. It's timestamped on my website, briankeenfitness.com. So you can literally just click that part and it'll bring you to this question. So hopefully that provides you with a lot of value and hopefully that helps. So as I said, this episode is coming from the Sahara Desert. It's not really, it's coming from Galway, but I am in the Sahara Desert right now. So if you want to follow my journey, be sure to head over to my Instagram, Brian Keen Fitness. I'm going to put on my GA hat very, very quickly, just for any GA players listening. My first ever GA muscle camp, which is a full day seminar in the Clayton Hotel in Galway City on the 12th of May from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. is officially kicking off, and tickets are available on briankeenfitness.com/events. So any GA players looking to come and spend the day with me, a full day seminar where we talk everything nutrition, training, supplements, sports psychology, and covering everything in terms of recovery, alcohol, that is going to move your performance to the next level and how to factor things in, is going to be on the Saturday, the 12th of May. So head over to the website, you can check that out and you can get your tickets. So that is everything, and hopefully you're all following my journey in the Sahara. As I said, the Laura Lynn link is on my Instagram in the highlights for anyone that wants to sponsor. They're an incredible charity for Children's Hospice, and a massive thank you to everybody who's donated already. They are just incredible at what they do in for working with sick children and the parents of sick and dying children. They're just absolutely amazing. So I'm so grateful to be able to run for them for the Marathon de Sable. So be sure to go check that out on Instagram. Thank you all for listening, and I'll catch you all next week when I am back from the Sahara.